From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are 5 days until Election Day, and a number of races are very tight. In Wisconsin, Republican Governor Scott Walker is in a dead heat with his Democratic challenger, State School Superintendent Tony Evers. Joining us now is Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jeremy.
So a lot of people outside of Wisconsin know Scott Walker, not just for his failed run for president in 2016, but for the fact that voters actually tried to recall him. At one point, it was the focus of the nation. Just remind us first what that dramatic chapter was all about.
Yeah. And because of that, this is actually his fourth statewide election here wow. in Wisconsin in the last 8 years. So what that recall was about was in 2011, shortly after taking office, Walker introduced a bill that would go on to become law that would basically scale back the power of public employee union here to collectively bargain, limit their power in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And unions pushed back. They forced a recall election of Walker in 2012. He won. So he's won in 2010 in that big Republican wave. He won in that recall election in 2012, won his re-election in 2014, and now here he is trying to seek a third term, something that's pretty rare.
And he's up against the state superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers. Tell us more about him, first of all. What is that job?
So the state superintendent of public instruction is officially a nonpartisan job. It's a job that a lot of people don't know about here. He runs the school system, but he doesn't get a whole lot of say in how to do that. So the legislature and the governor kind of decide what kind of budgets schools are going to work with, and it's Evers' job to basically make that work. He has, though, as part of that job, run for statewide office in Wisconsin 3 times. He's won with lopsided victories in all those races. And so this is his first time running as a Democrat in a statewide office, and obviously against a high-profile candidate opponent here in Wisconsin.
And he's had help from President Obama, who was just there.
Hello, Milwaukee!
And President Trump has also visited Wisconsin to campaign for Scott Walker.
Scott Walker is a tireless warrior. He is a warrior.
How much of this election is about Trump?
A lot of it's about Trump, and maybe not in ways that we would have guessed a few months ago, a year ago. The Republican Party here is really embracing President Trump. And his numbers here, actually, his approval rating in Wisconsin has kind of ticked steadily upward. Trump and Walker have both spoken very complimentary of one another. I mean, they were at one time opponents
right.
in that race for president during Governor Walker's
brief candidacy
there.
I forget whether Trump had a nickname for Walker.
They never advanced to a nickname stage.
Okay.
He did say some negative things about the way that Walker was running Wisconsin, but they're well beyond that now. They're very complimentary of one another. Trump praises Walker and vice versa for bringing a big Foxconn plant to
mm-hmm,
Wisconsin
right.
to build TVs here. They were both in on that. And really, there's no doubt about whether the Republican Party here is going to embrace Trump or kind of shy away from him. They're all in on the president.
Let's listen to a little highlight reel from the most recent gubernatorial debate. You'll hear Walker's voice first, talking about education, then Evers.
And so in this last budget, we invested more actual dollars into K-12 education than ever before.
Right now, school boards have less money, less state money than they have ever had.
Is education a big issue in this election?
When you ask people what they are voting about, what matters to them, they talk about education. And so Evers, because of that, brought some strength to this this election. He has been running schools for years. He's dedicated his life to schools. He was a teacher before he was a school administrator. So he's got a pretty long record there. Walker has a mixed record. His first budgets after he was elected included very deep cuts to public school spending. But his most recent budget, the one we're under right now here in Wisconsin, included a lot of new money for schools, a big increase in spending. That's the one that Governor Walker is campaigning on. And it's actually one that Evers a couple years ago said was a good budget.
What are the polls saying about the governor's race?
The polls right now are saying it is very close. The latest Marquette poll on this race, which will be the last poll from Marquette before the election, shows that Evers and Walker are tied with 47% each in the race for governor. So they are going to be pushing their own voters to get out as much as they can. And we've had early voting here in Wisconsin for a couple weeks now, so a lot of people have already voted.
That's Sean Johnson, who is Capital Bureau Chief at Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've long observed that different media look at the news, including the midterms, through different lenses. But we're wondering, has that escalated along with the rhetoric and the tensions in the news recently? On CNN this morning, Democratic strategist and CNN commentator Maria Cardona, in a conversation about trust in the media, said this.
You know who else we have to have trust in? The President of the United States. And what he does every single day when he opens his mouth is prove why we cannot trust him and why he is unfit to lead.
And turn around the same time to Fox News. This is what you heard from Fox and Friends co-host Ainsley Earhart.
If you're the President of the United States and every single time you turn on the TV, on most of the channels, they're misconstruing what you say. And you know your heart and you know your words and you know your voice. And then you watch other people report on what you say, and it's completely different than what you mean. Well, that has to be frustrating, and that's why he's saying it's fake news. And he's saying, if you don't want to be called the enemy, then get the story right.
Well, joining us now, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, we ask you in on occasion to help us with issues like this. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
And we had a producer watch both CNN and Fox News this morning for a half hour, 7 to 7:30 Eastern time. CNN largely picking apart President Trump's words, Fox going to lengths to defend them. Other days you might see Fox open the program, Fox and Friends, with the migrant caravan, which is 800 miles away and is legally seeking asylum. CNN might be focusing on news like the synagogue shootings. So here's the question. Has Fox, in part, certainly not, you know, Chris Wallace on Sunday morning, but has Fox largely become not just friendly to President Trump, but more like state TV? And has CNN become not just critical of a president when needed, but part of the opposition?
Well, wouldn't it be pretty to think so, that we could sort of say, you know, there's these two folks acting out, speaking loudly, and we can assign them sort of equivalent roles in frustrating roles, but nonetheless equivalent roles in sort of our information and disinformation cycle. In fact, what you're seeing is an asymmetrical dynamic play out. First off, it's worth, we heard the clips at the beginning. The commentator, the Democratic strategist on CNN, was paired with a Republican strategist this morning. But you actually heard the host of Fox and Friends, Ainsley Earhart, you said, make the comment that if you don't want to be the enemy, don't make mistakes in the media. Well, first off, that's a journalist. She has a journalism degree, as Brian Stelter, CNN, pointed out this morning. Ainsley Earhart does. And she's saying basically the enemy of the people in the – that's a fair term to assign for the press by the president if they make mistakes in reporting about him. That is not a journalistic position.
Well,
that's a demonizing position.
It's assuming they're mistakes when, in fact, often they're not.
Yeah. And one of the things I'd say is, you know, Fox repeatedly, you know, what you're seeing now is a purer version of what it has done for the last several years when it comes to Trump and for the last couple decades when it's come to the Republican Party. It's purified. But, you know, Fox invites on people and often has its own hosts and opinion personalities repeat things about liberals, about, let's say, immigrants coming from Latin America, about major Jewish liberal figures that are demonizing and not grounded in truth. You don't see CNN doing that on the liberal side. You don't see CNN repeatedly pumping up talking points the Democratic Party wants out there that demonize Republican figures or policies and do it without factual foundation. So there is an asymmetry in what the two sides are up to.
I've noticed actually that Fox News hosts will now refer to Democratic candidates as Democrat candidates, which is a total party line terminology. David, these channels are on in every newsroom in America. We spend a lot of time, you know, looking at them. How many viewers do they actually have?
Totally fair question. You know, Fox in its prime time, which depending on how you want to call it, you could consider it between 8 and 11 or 12 at night. You know, it more or less is generally going to get between, call it high 1.8 and mid to high 3 million viewers. So, it's typically less than 1% of the country. And CNN is going to get significantly less than that. On the other hand, it influences how the rest of the media thinks about stories. They influence how the political elites and leaders and candidates and donors think about news events. And also, you know, particularly in the case of Fox, it's almost like a pure drip into the most core voter for the Republican Party, and especially for President Trump. So it's a very effective channel for him. It influences people up and it influences people out in that way.
Well, but, you know, David, you've actually, you know, you've clarified how you feel Fox very different from CNN. But does the increasing adversarial tone on CNN bother you? It almost feels like at a time when you are feeling that the president is not telling you the truth, when you are feeling that pipe bombs that are mailed to your workspace came from a supporter of that president, it's almost the time to get even more sober and less adversarial.
Well, let's be very clear about it. Yeah. I'd say that CNN feels itself forced into an adversarial position, and I think that sometimes some of their folks like Jim Acosta act out. That is different than being partisan and being ideological. You can disagree with some of what CNN does without assigning it the same role that Fox plays on the other side.
Thank you. Recently, we went to New York in search of the comedy icon Elaine May, to which you're either saying, who? Or, oh my God, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, the comedy duo beginning in the 1950s that begat so many others with improv routines like this one, Elaine May playing Mike Nichols' needy mother.
I sat by that phone all day Friday.
Honey, I was working.
And all day Friday night.
Darling, I was in the lab.
And all day Saturday. And all day Sunday.
Mom.
And your father finally said to me, Phyllis, eat something, you'll faint. I said, no, Harry, no. I don't want my mouth to be full when my son calls it.
Elaine May made it okay for women to be comedians. Mike Nichols says the pair broke up because he became more afraid than Elaine did of the improv aspect. She was braver. Dick Cavett called them comic meteors. Both Nichols and May became filmmakers. She wrote the screenplay for Heaven Can Wait. Together they wrote The Birdcage, which Nichols also directed. But Elaine May directed the cult classic The Heartbreak Kid, about Lenny, who falls in love with another woman on his honeymoon, and he's about to tell his wife in a diner known for pecan pie, filled with anxiety, which he takes out on a hapless waiter who tells him there's no pecan pie.
Are you joking? What, how's it? No pecan pie?
Honey. Sorry, sir.
No pecan pie?
Honey, what are you doing? Do I
have... I mean, the main reason we came here is for the pecan pie.
Oh, that's all right.
No, it's not all right. I mean, they should have said that to us at the door. I mean, they should have warned us that there was a danger of running out of pecan pie.
Mike Nichols passed away in 2014. We hadn't heard much from Elaine May. And then, stunningly, there she is, returning to Broadway after 50 years in a remake of Kenneth Lonergan's Waverly Gallery, a memory play about his own grandmother, the Waverly Gallery being her art gallery in Greenwich Village. The original production starred Broadway great Eileen Heckart. Today, the curtain rises on a now 86-year-old Elaine May as Gladys Greene, telling her stage grandson, Lucas Hedges, about his parents' breakup. Elaine May is back.
I never knew anything was the matter. Your mother never told me anything. And then one day your father calls me on the phone, says he wants to drop by to say goodbye. He's moving out. I said, I don't understand what happened.
The play has an all-star cast, Joan Allen as Gladys's daughter, David Cromer as her son-in-law, and Michael Cera as the struggling artist a lonely Gladys allows to sleep in her gallery. And the play is about Alzheimer's and the toll it takes on families. We watch as we have Elaine May in our grasp and then begin to lose her over the course of the show, as elusive as ever. Even more so, because Elaine May hasn't given an interview in 50 years.
Hi.
So we sought to find Elaine May in actor Michael Cera and director Lila Neugebauer, an off-Broadway sensation making her Broadway debut with Ken Lonergan's play. We sat down and started talking, of course, about Elaine May. You know, I did an informal, unscientific polling during the intermission. I would say half the people I spoke with, they had no idea who Elaine May was. I said, oh, that's a lovely actress up there. The others were there because of Elaine May. For you and Ken, this was a dream.
It was. I mean, yes, admittedly, I am under 40, but she's someone whose work and legend, just kind of general astonishingness, was very much something I was aware of. And I think her humanity felt so particularly well-suited to this role.
But how did you know that an 86-year-old actress was going to be able to sustain this?
It's hard not to bet on Elaine.
The truth is, the reason that I wanted to do this show was because of Elaine. I got like an email from my agent saying they're putting this together with Elaine, and I immediately emailed, begged him basically to let me be anywhere near the show.
And why?
Well, she's sort of my favorite director and one of my favorite performers, and then I got to meet her 4 years ago. We had lunch together and got to know each other, and then we had...
Wait, you got to meet Elaine May?
Yeah. She was very accessible. I think I've learned recently that Elaine had no concept of any of my work or anything when she met me. She just said yes, just in a friendly sense.
When you say her films or her directing, what about it?
What about it? Well, it's very powerful. I mean, she only made 4 films, and there's an incredible range in them. She made The Heartbreak Kid, which is, I think, my favorite movie ever made. I can watch it really any time. And then the next thing she did was Mikey and Nikki, which was this very moving, dramatic, shattering work. So she has these 4 films, and they display an incredible range.
Well, others have said even her flop, which was considered one of the biggest in history, Ishtar, fabulous.
I'll take it. Yeah, I love it. It's better than a lot of things I've seen.
So, Michael, now you're on stage with her. Obviously, she's got the stamina. I mean, it's just stunning. What's the life force? What does it feel like?
Wow. It's very exciting. Elaine's really alive on stage, so our scenes are very different every night, depending on... like, last night was really fun when she said... She has a line in the show where she says, there's a lot of people in the neighborhood now from South Korea. Last night she said North Korea. And it made her laugh a lot. Then she was basically laughing throughout the rest of the scene, which we just had to, you know, pretend was intentional.
She said people from North Korea, you know, with all their clothes, their nice clothes.
And then the next scene, there's like a echo of that line. She says to the family, there's a lot of people in the neighborhood from South Korea. And Joan has a line, what is this South Korea thing? So Elaine, in between scenes, she was like, what am I going to say in the next scene now? And she just said, there's a lot of people from Korea now. It's a pretty good fix.
It seemed to me, Ken Lonergan writes family, you know, and this is his family, and right. Cutting each other off, talking over each other, 3 conversations going on at one time.
She used to have this psychotic Dalmatian.
Zeke.
Which is spelled
Z-I-Q-U-E. Who used to hide under the table when anybody came into the room.
And who she used to take on these cruises where they didn't allow dogs.
And she'd say...
Oh, no, they don't allow dogs on that boat, but I just take her anyway.
They don't mind. This
is the craziest... That's what's really striking about this play when you read it and see it, I think, is that, those overlaps are very particular to this play, how many of them there are and how intensive they are, like dual conversations, and you just, as an audience, kind of like choose your own adventure in a way. In rehearsals, it kind of took a while for us to all sync up with that stuff because they have to be actually very specific. They sound very loose, but they can't be loose at all or else the timing gets off.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think part of the pleasure and challenge of working on a play like this is that to achieve the effect of this kind of spontaneously rolling hypernaturalism, it actually requires tremendous technical virtuosity. It's scripted within an inch of its life, certainly, yeah.
You know, the young man in the gallery who wants to put up a show?
He is putting up a show.
He told me he's leaving.
What?
He's going back to where he lives.
He is not.
He's packing up.
He's not.
He's leaving me with
he's
the
not leaving.
Stop talking.
Listen. He's just going home for the weekend. He will be back on Monday.
Who told you that?
He did.
As Elaine May's character fades, again, I went back and I watched Eileen Heckert just to see some of it on YouTube. I recommend it. It's amazing.
Oh, I didn't know it was on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a kind of a sad note. She died, actually, shortly after you're nodding, Lila. And here you are. I mean, it is Elaine May, and she's a prose pro. We all face our own mortality, but she's closer to hers than others might be, you know, and here she is enacting it. Was any of that difficult?
You know, at the first lunch that Elaine and I had, we talked specifically about the unmasterable challenge of how to enter the psychology of a person who's grappling with dementia. That was very much at the forefront of our minds. The play, I think, invites all of us to confront that which we are so often in the process of denying. What Kenny has done so masterfully is the kind of erosion of textual continuity in that character's language. That does a lot of the work. Of course, Elaine has to figure out how to make sense of that, and I think does so quite beautifully.
My grandson writes for a newspaper, and if you show him your work, he might just write it up.
What paper does he write for? What paper does he write for? Does he?
Well, if you want to put some of these up, a few of these up, we can do it and see what happens.
Of course, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, you know, it's not a big gallery, but it's cute. And a lot of students come here and they look around and we talk and they show me their work. There's some very good artists, but they have no one to help them. So this is not a fancy gallery, but it's okay.
No, I really like it. It has a lot of character.
I used to give many shows here, but I don't give that many anymore.
As you watched this, I mean, it's just pretty extraordinary to see this woman before our eyes fade.
Yeah, it's completely stunning every night. I've become almost, like, desensitized to how astounding it is, what she's doing. I can't quite have the emotional experience watching it. I'm watching it technically. But I watch the show, like, next to people backstage who are really riding the emotion of it and see them crying. It makes me feel a little like some kind of bot or something, because I'm just standing there, like, calculating the changes they've made. But it really, it's just impressive to me.
Oh, look at the dog. She's crying.
No, she's not.
Yeah, she's crying because she wants to come in here, because nobody's talking to her.
I'm going to start dinner.
That's actor Michael Cera, along with director Lila Neugebauer, talking about the new production of Kenneth Lonergan's Waverly Gallery, starring Joan Allen, David Cromer, Lucas Hedges, and the indomitable Elaine May. Run, don't walk. More at hearandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Open enrollment for 2019 begins today in the Affordable Care Act's insurance marketplaces. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is still around and seems to be stabilizing, even with the Trump administration's efforts to weaken it. Joining us now is NPR's Allison Kojak. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Jeremy.
And in previous years, costs were going up. The number of insurers offering plans was going down. Overall, what is the state of the ACA as open enrollment begins today for 2019?
So, today, the market's going to look a lot like it did last year. Costs have stabilized and are even slightly down across the country. In some states, average premiums are quite low. They're about $250 a month. But, you know, it varies state to state. So in some, the average premium is about $700 a month. So the big thing to remember is people can get subsidies. So those sticker prices are one thing, but most people who buy insurance on the individual market qualify for subsidies that bring those premiums down.
And what are you expecting to see in terms of enrollment this year? And it is a shorter period than usual.
Yeah, the Trump administration reduced the enrollment period to about 6 weeks from last year. And those are for the states that are on the federal marketplace. Some states have their own marketplaces, and those have longer enrollment periods. But most analysts say they expect to see a similar level of enrollment in states where there's longer enrollment periods and more marketing, like California or New York. They are likely to see maybe an uptick. But there will probably be some migration of young, healthy people off the ACA markets and onto what are these new short-term policies. They have lower sticker prices, but people have to be really careful because they also have fewer benefits. But they're being marketed pretty hard, so people should really ask questions if they're looking at one of those plans.
But you're saying overall enrollment is likely to be stable, even though there's no individual mandate anymore that requires people to buy health insurance or pay a fee.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because last year the Trump administration really stopped enforcing the individual mandate, even though it was legally there still was a penalty. So this year that penalty is gone. And that's why you'll see probably some people leaving. But there are also a lot of choices out there. And so people who really want insurance are going to be able to find it. And those subsidies, and people are learning about this, those subsidies stabilize their prices quite a lot. So if you bought insurance before, there's a good chance you're going to want to keep that insurance.
Okay, I want to ask you about one more thing. The midterms are coming up in just a few days. A lot of Republicans are running for office saying that they will protect coverage for pre-existing conditions. This is a very popular part of the Affordable Care Act. Democrats also saying they will protect that coverage. But given that a lot of these Republicans who are saying that actually voted against Obamacare, voted to repeal Obamacare, which would have meant getting rid of that protection, what's to be believed?
Well, I would be quite skeptical of Republicans who voted multiple times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, now promising to protect pre-existing conditions. And it's because there's a lot of evidence out there. There were several bills put in front of Republican lawmakers last year, at least five, and they approved them. Many Republicans voted for them in the House and in the Senate. And all of those bills changed or repealed the protections for pre-existing conditions. Mm. Some of them got rid of them altogether. Some of them just took away certain types of coverage, which, if you need that type of coverage, is repealing your pre-existing condition coverage.
That's Allison Kojak, health policy correspondent for NPR. Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Last week's attempted mail bomb attacks and the hate crime shootings in Louisville and Pittsburgh have raised questions about the role of social media in promoting hate speech. Our colleagues at the podcast Endless Thread have been talking to a group of elite users at the social media platform Reddit who are trying to turn some of that hate speech on its head. They're taking over certain subreddits, that's what discussion threads are called on Reddit, and turning them from cesspools of bad stuff into funny stuff. For example, one Redditor took over the Nazi subreddit r/stormfront and turned it into a place where people post about weather patterns. Endless Thread host and Here and Now contributor Ben Brock Johnson has this story.
Meet Melinda Brown of North Carolina, known on Reddit as T. Dumpsford.
I'm a trans woman. I'm 48 years old, and I spend most of my time on Reddit fighting against hate speech, and I'm very active in activism in real life as well.
Melinda's life story is her own, but the challenges she has faced may sound familiar.
I grew up in Charlotte. A pretty stereotypical queer childhood. I didn't have a lot of friends. I got beat up a lot, you know, the usual. But it wasn't really until a couple years ago that I started transition that I felt completely comfortable and happy with myself. But leading up to that point, I don't know, I'd had a divorce, and that's sort of what threw me into that tailspin. And I realized that, you know what, you're going to have to fix this because I'm not going down without a fight.
Part of Melinda's way of fighting was finding the trans community on Reddit. In a world where roadmaps for trans people can be hard to find, Reddit's trans-focused communities have become crucial for advice and support. Melinda found this trove of information and interaction along with some other useful Reddit content.
I mean, there's awesome stuff on there. You can learn about dinosaurs and horticulture and, I mean, all kinds of things. It's great. The good outnumbers the bad. Sometimes you can't hear the good because the bad is so damn loud.
Because the bad is so loud, Melinda has become focused on subreddit takeovers. She's part of this elite force.
I'd say there's a cohort of about 20 of us who are plugged into social justice. We're not all queer, but a lot of us are.
We talked with several trans women fighting this fight on Reddit. Here's how it works. Reddit has a massive ecosystem of communities that are each managed by volunteer moderators, also called mods. Just like any user, when mods break the larger website's rules, the company administrators can strip them of their moderator powers and ban their user account. That's when these Reddit power users can swoop in and become the new moderators of a subreddit. The trans women we talked to also have special interests and focus areas, like this woman, who we're going to identify only by her Reddit username.
Hi, I'm Drewy Poodle on Reddit.
Drewy Poodle is famous for turning a subreddit named after a homophobic slur, containing equally offensive content, into a community focused on one of the word's other definitions, where users post photos of bundles of sticks. That move inspired others.
Hi, I'm Penny Oaken. I go by Bardfin on Reddit.
Penny's claim to fame, or one of them, is taking over a subreddit called White Rights and turning it into an artistic discussion about shades of the color white. Think eggshell versus polar bear. That community's since been banned, but it was part of the mission.
Let's make it so that this completely subverts the expectations of anybody who visits this subreddit. And there's going to be a lot of people who have a lot of hatred in their heart who type in this URL, and we did.
Some of these subreddits are defunct or unclaimed. Others are more active. And Melinda has used a different approach to take over some of these subreddits. She has gone undercover, infiltrated hateful communities to try to take them over from the inside like a Trojan horse. Melinda tells us about one such takeover of a subreddit we also can't name on the air. It was focused on shaming women for being sexually active.
It was created by someone who I was aware of. And I literally just asked the guy, hey, can I mod here? And he was like, yeah, okay.
Melinda was part of the subreddit moderator's private conversations. And she says she tried to keep a low profile while participating enough in the chatter to fit in behind enemy lines. It's often a waiting game because these users will eventually break the rules.
And then slowly but surely, all because they're horrible people, all their accounts started getting banned until I was the last one standing. But the content that we wiped when we took it over was horrible. I mean, it was just horrible, you know, and we just deleted everything. And then we started posting body positivity and stuff like that. And it made the old subscriber base who used to post the hateful content, it made them so mad. And that's where they start accusing us of being the real bad guy because we hate free speech. We don't hate free speech. We don't hate anybody. We just won't tolerate hate. And if people want to spin this narrative that their speech is sacrosanct and what we're doing is horrible and terrible, I can't help them. I'm not going to change their minds. And I'm not going to try to. And, you know, I mean, if someone comes into your living room and starts ranting about black people or gay people or something, you're going to throw them out of your house. And I don't understand why Reddit doesn't do that. Throw them out.
This is a fair question. So we figured we should talk to our partners in making our podcast, Reddit, and ask them about subreddit takeovers.
I'm Christine Molenburnt, and I'm a community manager at Reddit.
What does that mean?
So the best way that I can think of to describe my job is that I'm a bridge between the community and my company.
Christine says there's actually a subreddit community devoted to these takeovers. It's called Reddit Request.
You can petition to take over a subreddit. And in order to take it over, the subreddit pretty much has to be orphaned. And then we review the person making the request. And if we feel the request is being made in good faith, then we will go ahead and transfer the subreddit over. We'll remove any dormant mods that are there, and then we'll add the new person on.
How would you describe Reddit's approach when it comes to policing things like hate speech or moderating things like hate speech on the site? That's got to be a tricky needle to thread, right?
So we don't police belief. We police behavior. We believe that community governance works, and our communities are allowed to create their own rules kind of on top of our own site-wide policies, and we equip them to govern themselves in the way that works the best for them.
Some of the users we've talked to point out a complexity here or an issue here, which is these subreddits are being taken over, but they're not just being straight banned. Why is that?
Well, again, you know, we don't police belief. We police behavior. So when it comes to enforcing, like, we focus on the site-wide rules and our policies. And if a community is breaking those consistently, then we are going to action them. And if it gets to that point, then we have a team, our trust and safety team, that that can speak to that a little more in depth than I could.
Sure.
But, you know, if a community has been actioned to the point where that we have banned it, then, you know, that's because they have consistently and constantly broken our rules, and that's it.
We should say there are Redditors who believe and advocate for more free speech across the site. Endless Thread spoke with two of them, and their philosophy goes like this. The more that Redditors take over subreddits and the more administrators help to facilitate these takeovers, the more they are endorsing a certain set of beliefs and squashing opportunities for discourse. But there's also a lot of support for the argument that allowing bigoted hateful speech isn't helpful for discourse either, and actually makes it more difficult. And the women we talked to said over and over again that this isn't about erasing ideas they disagree with. It is about erasing safe spaces for people who threaten their existence. And even though their main goal may be replacing hateful content with jokes, Reddit power users like Drewy Poodle say that sometimes they get more than laughs.
I've gotten PMs from people, direct messages that said, hey, you know, it's like, thanks for that post. You actually, instead of yelling at me, you actually explained it enough that I can kind of, you know, I've changed my mind. Like, I'm sorry for the hate.
For Here and Now, I'm Ben Brock Johnson.
The University of Maryland reversed course last night and fired football coach DJ Durkin. The firing came less than 24 hours after the University Board of Regents had reinstated Durkin as head coach. He had been on administrative leave since August while the board oversaw two investigations into the Maryland football program Durkin oversaw. The investigations followed the death of 19-year-old player Jordan McNair, who had collapsed during practice on May 29th and died a few days later. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And start with what happened to Jordan McNair.
He was subject to an extremely intense and irresponsible, I think we could safely say, off-season workout regimen where his body temperature rose to 106 degrees and this wasn't properly addressed. And just getting him to that point showed, according to internal findings, terrible judgment on behalf of the coaching staff. And we should say the college football works that there are only – the way it works is that strength and conditioning coaches have an outsized role because officially head coaches and position coaches are only allowed a certain amount of contact with the players. So players go for this offseason conditioning, which is allowed, and oftentimes the guy who is, you know, maybe eighth on the hierarchy chart in terms of actually where he stands has this outsized power and influence. So Maryland's tough offseason program, cruel offseason program, essentially killed this poor kid. And then an investigation showed that the head coach had allowed a toxic culture to exist at the program.
Okay, but then let's talk about the chain of events because they've changed their position on this. On Tuesday, the university's Board of Regents Chair James Brady announced that Durkin, the coach, was being reinstated. Here's what Brady said then.
We believe that he is a good man and a good coach who is devoted to the well-being of the student athletes under his charge. He is also at the beginning of his coaching career with a great deal of promise and much still to learn. We believe he deserves that opportunity.
And then last night, the university's president announced Durkin was fired. What happened?
What happened was, after the Board of Regents essentially announced that the person who had ultimate responsibility for students wouldn't pay any price, there was an upheaval among the following constituencies. The students at the school, much of the team who was extremely upset that their friend and, you know, as they said, fallen brother, was that there was no accountability for that. Also upset was literally the governor of Maryland and other important elected officials. And reportedly, the president of the university did not agree with the Board of Regents directive. President Lowe decided to do was to say, I will not fire the coach. It is my job and not the regent's job to fire the coach, but I will be resigning at the end of the year, sort of to fall on his sword. But in the 24 hours since, when there was a huge backlash to this announcement, things have changed.
And this was the reaction on television. This is Trevor Maddich, a college football analyst on ESPN, after the news broke that Durkin had been fired.
They had to do this because there was no way Maryland could move forward with DJ Durkin as the coach. There's no way that the family of Jordan McNair could close this chapter and move on from here with DJ Durkin as the coach.
Mike, this wasn't about one person, though. Is there a case to be made that the program should be shut down?
Yeah, but who's going to make that case? Maybe you or I could make that case, or people from afar who watch college football. But the Board of Regents, remember, beyond, they're the ones who would shut down a program. Beyond not even shutting down a program, they wanted to keep the coach. Football is a huge cash cow for the school. The University of Maryland, though not a football school and not good at football, moved to the Big Ten, which is a football conference. They make upwards of $100 million a year in terms of revenue from their sport. And they were saying 24 hours ago that despite the death of a player, we still think the coach is so good at coaching X's and O's that we want to keep him. So I think as I look at this, I think a rational outsider, or rational enough to think that the irrational world of college football should be allowed to continue as it is, a rational outsider would say, wow, something should happen. But inside that program, and for the people who are the gatekeepers of that program, there is none of that incentive to scrap the program altogether.
Mike, I want to ask you one more thing while we have you, which is the World Series trophy damaged by a fan in the parade in Boston who threw a beer can, I guess an open beer can, at the players in the who are holding the trophy. What are your thoughts on that? What happened?
Two phrases, peak Boston, and sorry to insult the city, but but Bostonians at one point are the most brilliant people on earth, and yet at the other point, you can argue that they're the most, let us say, driven by id. So I don't know what the brand of beer was, but I could see, you know, a Sam Adams finding its way.
And actually, they were full. They were full.
I know. It doesn't make any sense. Who throws a full beer can at people and people holding a very...
They wanted to give him a beer.
...valuable thing.
Yeah.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.